Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show planned for all of you today. My guest will be Mark Winnie. He's the author of the new book, Stand Together or Starve Alone, and founder of many agricultural policy groups, which I'll tell you about in a little bit when I invite him on. But I first want to share with you some things going on in and around the news and some events you might want to participate in and, of course, share my weekly recipe with you. So first, I want to tell you that there is an upcoming conference which my guest, today's guest, Mark Winnie, will be the keynote speaker at. And the conference is called the State of Long Island Local Suburban Agriculture and Where Do We Go From Here? And that conference will be on April 19th at Hofstra University from 9 to 1 p.m. And it's being sponsored by Hofstra University, but also by the Long Island Food Coalition, which is an organization that I am a part of. And it's trying to bring the different stakeholders on Long Island together to create a food policy that really is sustainable and moving forward towards providing a strong local food movement, a regional food movement here on Long Island and in the New York area that supports and promotes healthy, organic, nutritional food that is strengthening to our communities and to each of us. So I'll tell you more about the conference later when Mark comes on. But I also want to share some other things going on that you may want to take part of. Of course, today is International Women's Day. So there is a International Global Meditation going on tonight, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 6 p.m. Pacific Time. And you can find out more about that at the International Global Women's Day. Just Google that and you'll find the link to the Global Sisterhood Meditation, which will be taking place this evening. But it's wonderful to just take the time to honor women around the world, especially those that are working towards a sustainable food movement. And it's amazing that the majority of the small farmers working in other countries really are women. Women are really making a difference here in the sustainable food movement. So it's wonderful to take a moment to step back and honor all the women working for that. Tomorrow there's a webinar for how to shift power in the food justice movement, and that is being sponsored by the Chesapeake Bay Food Shed. And the purpose of this webinar is really to try to shift the power, you know, and put it in the hands of people of color and low-income residents who are impacted by policies that are implemented and very often don't have a voice in that, in the forming of those policies. So trying to find ways and strategies to engage people of color and low-income residents to take ownership of these food programs, and that's the purpose of this webinar. And it's a free webinar tomorrow from 12 to 1, and you can go to the ChesapeakeFoodShed.net to register for that. March 16th is the 6th Annual Massachusetts Urban Farming Conference. That will be taking place at Bunker Hill Community College. And it just brings together, you know, all the stakeholders, farmers, and community activists working to create a sustainable regional food system in Massachusetts. March 17th, there's a Plant a Row for the Hungry workshop at the Port Washington Library on Long Island, and they've had a very successful program in encouraging people to grow a row on their own property to donate to food pantries. As you know, food pantries don't have enough fresh produce. They get a lot of food stable, shelf-stable foods, which are not the healthiest. So this is helping to bring fresh produce to those that might need it. March 22nd, there is an event going on at Organic Crush in Woodbury, and that is a program called Busting Food Myths. And Dr. Robert Graham, who's a board-certified integrative doctor and founder of Fresh Med New York City, and Stephanie Sachs, who is a nutritionist and founder of Reboot Food and also the author of What the Fork Are You Eating. They'll be coming together at Organic Crush to talk about food and some of the myths that are out there about our health. So that should be interesting. Slow Food, which is an organization I'm very, very involved in, and it's very close to my heart. Slow Food East End is sponsoring a movable feast, which is an opportunity to support the Joshua Levine Edible School Garden Program that is taking place out on the East End. And Sam Cass, who is a former White House chef for the Obama administration, along with Richard McCarthy, who's the executive director of Slow Food USA, we'll be together in a discussion about food. So that's taking place out at Dodds and Etter Landscape Design Showroom in Sag Harbor, if you'd like to go to that. March 25th is the annual Just Food Conference taking place in New York City up at the Teachers College at Columbia University. This annual event is always a great, great event. It does sell out, so if you're interested in going, purchase your tickets. Scholarships are available. The theme this year is Persist and Resist. And it brings together, you know, all types of urban and rural growers, social justice activists, food entrepreneurs, CSA core group leaders, community-run farmers, market managers, youth justice leaders, food policy advocates, all other sectors, just coming together to discuss lots of different workshops and hands-on opportunities. So if you are interested, that is Sunday, March 25th. Definitely a worthwhile experience. March 28th, the Pro Bono Partnership, which is a wonderful nonprofit organization that brings free legal counsel to nonprofits. They are having a free workshop out on Long Island at the Miller Business Resource Center. So if you're thinking about starting a nonprofit, if you have questions about it, come meet the people from the Pro Bono Partnership. It's a great event, and like I said, it's free, and that is Wednesday, March 28th from 9 to 11. And Green Thumb Growers Conference is taking place in the city. It's sponsored by the New York City Green Parks, and this is their 40th anniversary. So they are honoring our roots, featuring a keynote address by Karen Washington, who is a wonderful pioneer and advocate for community gardens and food justice. She's wonderful, so definitely worth checking that out. That's March 31st from 8 to 4. It's all day long. Only costs $5. It's at the Borough of Manhattan Community College. There's also a food justice certified training program taking place from April 2nd to April 5th. And that's going to take place at the Woolman Hill Quaker Retreat Center in Massachusetts. And this is sponsored by the Agricultural Justice Project. So if you're interested in becoming a food justice certified activist, this training might be for you. So check that out. And you can probably find it on the website of the Agricultural Justice Project. Also, the 6th Annual Sustainable Garden Conference is coming up at the Farmingdale State College. That's April 14th. It's an all-day event, and you can find out more about that at the Farmingdale State College website. Also, Change Food is having an event. This will be the second Change Food meetup, and that is taking place at the Ag Tech X Co-Lab in Brooklyn. So you can go to changefood.org to find out more information about that. That's going to be on April 18th from 6:30 to 8:30. And Diane, who runs Change Food, is really working to put these meetups together to bring people who are working in the food advocacy and chefs and, you know, people in the food movement coming together to meet each other. So it's a wonderful opportunity to do that if you can make it. And like I said, April 19th is the Long Island Food Conference, which you definitely want to try to make it to. And I would see you there. And so all those events you can find on my website at I Eat Green. And now I'd like to share with you my recipe. This week I did an herbed tofu medallions with shiitake mushroom coulée. And this is, I've been experimenting more and more with cooking without oil. Since I have registered and am a new teacher for the Whole Kids Foundation, which is, they have a healthy teachers program where I am going around to different public schools and teaching teachers and staff how to eat healthier. And they promote a plant-based diet without oil and without salt. And so I am working on creating more recipes that are low salt and no oil. So that this recipe is that. So there's three different parts to this recipe. One is, just the tofu ingredients. One is for the sautéed shiitake mushrooms, and one is the sauce. So for the tofu, you need 1 cake of organic extra firm tofu cut into 1/4-inch slices, and then I have them into triangles. So they had a nice shape. 1/4 cup of good-tasting nutritional yeast, 1/2 teaspoon of dried thyme, 1/2 teaspoon of marjoram, 1 teaspoon of garlic powder, 1/2 teaspoon oregano, 1/4 teaspoon salt, and 1/8 teaspoon pepper. And I just made a breading with that, and then I breaded each of the tofu cutlets in that mixture. For the shiitake mushrooms, I used 1/4 cup of diced shallots, 1/4 cup of celery, finely chopped, 3 cloves garlic, minced and pressed, 2 cups of sliced shiitake mushrooms, 2 to 4 tablespoons of water, 1/4 cup of red wine, 2 teaspoons tamari, 1 tablespoon chopped sage, fresh ground pepper, and 1 tablespoon chopped parsley. And for the sauce, I used 1 cup of vegetable stock, 1 tablespoon red wine, 1 tablespoon of mashed avocado, and that's where I got my oil from, 1 clove garlic, and 1 tablespoon chopped parsley. So you start by making that mixture with the nutritional yeast and the herbs, and I put it into a pie pan. That's what I use when I'm breading things. And I laid the tofu into the mixture and breaded it on all sides with the nutritional yeast mixture. And then I laid it out on a cookie sheet that was lined with parchment paper so I didn't have to use any oil. And I baked that at a 400-degree oven for 20 to 30 minutes. You really want it to get crispy on the outside. And so halfway through, about 10, 15 minutes into it, I turned them over and then cooked it the rest of the way on the other side. Meanwhile, while that's cooking in the oven, I sautéed the shallots in a dry cast iron pan. And when they started to stick, I added 1 tablespoon of water. And you can add 1 tablespoon of water at a time, depending on how much you need. And you also can adjust the heat so that it doesn't stick too much. But in the Healthy Teachers program, they talk about caramelizing onions, or they teach caramelizing onions just using water, cooking it in a cast iron pan and just adding 1 tablespoon of water at a time till you get that caramelization going. So I did that with the shallots. Then I added the celery and the garlic and continued sautéing, adding 1 tablespoon as needed. Then I added the shiitake mushrooms and continued cooking. And when the shiitake mushrooms started to get soft and wilt, that's when I added 1/4 cup of red wine, the tamari, the pepper, and the sage. And I cooked that until the liquid had evaporated and the mushrooms really just, they absorbed all that flavor. And then I removed the mushrooms into a bowl and set them aside for a bit. I added some parsley to that bowl and mixed it up. And then using the same pan, I added 1 cup of vegetable stock, 1 tablespoon of wine, and started to cook that down. I added the garlic clove and cooked it for about 5 minutes until it reduced in about half. Then I whisked in the mashed avocado until it was smooth. I added the parsley, and then I removed the tofu when that was done from the oven, laid it out on the platter, put the coulée sauce over it, and then topped it with the fresh mushrooms, the shiitake mushrooms, and I garnished it with some more fresh parsley and served it immediately, and it was delicious. It was really great. So, the tofu kind of dries out a bit when you're not cooking it in any oil, so the sauce really gave it back that moisture that was needed, and it was just delicious. So I hope you make the recipe, and of course, if you do, please share it with me. I love hearing from everybody when they make my recipes, how they like it. So now it's my pleasure to introduce to you my guest, who is Mark Winnie. And Mark is a food activist and author of the new book, Stand Together or Starve Alone, Unity and Chaos in the U.S. Food Movement. And it's a call for collaboration. Mark, as I said, will also be the keynote speaker for the Long Island Food Coalition's conference called The State of Long Island Local Suburban Agriculture, Where Do We Go From Here?, which will be at Hofstra University on April 19th. And as a food activist and co-founder of a number of food and agricultural policy groups, including the City of Hartford Food Policy Commission, the Connecticut Food Policy Council, End Hunger Connecticut, and the National Community Food Security Coalition, Mark really recognizes the need for us all to work together if we really want to move forward in this movement and make some progress. He also was the organizer and chairman of the Working Lands Alliance, which is a statewide coalition working to preserve Connecticut's farmland, and he's a founder of the Connecticut Farmland Trust. Mark was also a member of the United States delegation to the 2000 World Conference on Food Security in Rome, and is a 2001 recipient of the U.S. Department of Agriculture Secretary's Plow Honor Award. Mark was also, from 2002 to 2004, was a Food and Society Policy Fellow, which was a position that's supported by the W.K. Kellogg Foundation. And now he's a senior advisor at the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future. And I will tell you more about him. Mark, are you with me?
I am. Hi.
Hi. Thanks so much for joining me. I don't know where you found the time to do all that you have done. So on behalf of the food movement, I thank you for all that you have done.
Well, just live a long time and you'll get something done.
Yeah, right. Can you share with us, before I get into, you know, talking about your book and what you're up to right now, can you share with us a little bit of your history? Like, how did you first get into the food movement?
Oh, boy. Well, I would say the first place of entry was in college, where I realized that I was very interested in social change. And we're going back a very long time here, but I was interested in how we can bring about a better world, sort of broadly. And food was the entry point. It was kind of the gateway for me. I realized, somewhat, maybe being somewhat facetious, that you didn't have to know a whole lot in order to get involved with food. And so it was a good place for a 20-year-old know-nothing to sort of make a start. And I got involved in doing food co-op work and organizing breakfast programs in low-income neighborhoods, and eventually farmers markets and community gardens and that kind of thing. And just went from there. I was hooked, and I just couldn't stop.
Mm-hmm. And you managed to find ways to support yourself in it, which is also amazing, because
it was remarkable.
So much of the work is
still surprised.
Yeah, so much of the work is volunteer work. So being able to actually create a career out of it is amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's. I mean, there's definitely a whole lot more opportunity now, however, to get involved in food work and food system work. And there's many more entry points. And of course, there's, as I talk about in my book, there's also a large number of, you know, food study programs. You can get degrees at both a undergraduate and graduate level in something that will take you into a food career. Very little of that existed at the time that, you know, I was going through school. So I was fortunate, because I think I decided to make my own way. I decided, again, that food was a great place to do some good work. And it just kept growing and growing. And I'm very, I look back over the course of almost 50 years and say it's been a great ride. So I'm very happy.
Right. Good. So your new book is great. It touches on something that I have been frustrated with for so long, because as one person who's involved in the food movement, it's impossible to join every march and every protest and every webinar and everything, because there's so many of them. And, and how do you pick? And why can't they just all be together and work towards, instead of going around on this treadmill like a gerbil's wheel, how do we really propel ourselves forward? And it just makes sense that we need to work together. So how did you first come up with your title?
Well, I came up with that because I remembered the famous, I think it's semi-famous anyway, Benjamin Franklin quote about how kind of admonishing the patriots at the time of 1776, I think, that, you know, we either have to hang together or we're going to hang alone. And I thought about that in terms of that idea, in terms of the food movement, how over the course of my career, I've been so interested in trying to bring people together and trying to get them to work together. And it's always been a lot like herding cats, and people want to go off and do their own thing, which I certainly admire and I think is necessary and important. But there also has to be a place where you come together and agree to work together, hence the idea that we need to stand together. And that as time has gone on, I've been somewhat discouraged by the fact that the food problems that we're trying to address, we haven't made enough of a dent. In some cases, I'm not sure we've made any progress at all. And at the same time, I mean, the ironic part of this is that there has been enormous growth in food activity. I mean, just look at your calendar you just read for food events in March. It's, mm-hmm. you know, in one region, it's extraordinary. And you know, somebody would probably have to be a full-time job to go to all of them. So why on one hand do we have so much activity, you know, so many different kinds of food events, so many different sort of interests and various permutations on the food movement, yet we still have very high rates of hunger and food insecurity. We have very high rates of obesity and overweight and diabetes, and we still are far short of having a sustainable food system, sustainable agriculture system. So that's the story behind the title, that we have got to work together. I mean, you use the term a call to collaboration, and I like that. I think that's where, as a food movement, we have to spend more time collaborating and somewhat less time, perhaps, beating our own drum.
Mm-hmm. You know, in your book, you talk about how the food movement's kind of lagging behind. You know, and some of the efforts to improve the food system. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, you just touched on food insecurity. Has it gotten any better? I know obesity rates have certainly gone in the wrong direction. We all know that. But I think, you know, with CAFOs and the industrial food system, you know, expanding, we're just getting more toxins in our water. Can you talk about a little bit about that, where the food movement is lagging behind and some of the efforts to make it better?
Yes. I try to go by the numbers. I've been fortunate to be able to spend a few years on a part-time basis with the Center for a Livable Future at Johns Hopkins at the Bloomberg School of Public Health. And I've come to respect perhaps the numbers and the research and the science behind things a little more than I have in the past. But, I mean, it's discouraging when you find that, you know, over 12% of Americans are considered food insecure. And you compare that to the year 2000 when the number was 10%. You know, during the Great Recession, the number went up to like 14 or 15%. And it came down, obviously, a little bit, but it still hasn't returned to kind of pre-recession levels. And, you know, you have to ask the question, why? At the same time, as you mentioned, obesity just is off the charts. I just yesterday attended a symposium on obesity and the food system, and an array of well-respected researchers presented their work, and the numbers are pretty scary. And if they, you know, just the fact that you have so many overweight and obese children in the teenage bracket especially, and that, you know, that's about, if you're obese at the age of 15, you have about a 60% chance of being obese as an adult, which is pretty much of a straight line to diabetes. And the numbers really are quite shocking. And if you just look at the overall direction of the food system, in spite of the fact that we have, you know, 8,500 or more farmers markets around the country, a huge growth in that arena, you know, we're largely dependent on a food system that is not sustainable, that is polluting our waterways, that relies on factory farms, is still dependent, you might say, on the non-therapeutic use of antibiotics in livestock, And, you know, there's been the industry, the food industry has made some progress in reducing unhealthy ingredients, the amount of salt, sugar, fat, and so forth in processed food. But it's, you know, when you still, the research hasn't necessarily supported that there's been a big change in the product mix, particularly at restaurants that cater to young people. So, you know, there's, anyone can muster, you know, their numbers and their data. And in one sense, we have seen progress. The progress has been in the amount of action and interest and public awareness. You see it every day in terms of the number of people gardening and going to farmers markets and the growth in farm-to-school programs. That's been a wonderful direction, about 43,000, 42,000, I believe, schools in the United States have some form of farm-to-school, so the kids are getting food grown locally in their cafeterias, but it's still a small percentage given the overall size of our nation's food system.
Mm-hmm. And I know you said food insecurity is about 12% or so, but I think amongst women and children, it's almost like 25%. I mean, it is
higher.
The numbers for that, it's really high, right?
Yeah, it is higher. It is higher. And, you know, I think part of the issue, of course, is poverty and the income and wealth disparities in the United States. I mean, we can't just look at the numbers around food insecurity. We can't just look at the number of people who may be going to a food bank or a food pantry. We have to sort of look at what's behind that. And so while I don't devote a lot of time or discussion to it in my book, the income and wealth gap in this country is really the big challenge, I feel, because it does take us down the road to poverty, and poverty is what takes us down the road to hunger and food insecurity, and to some extent to some of our other diet-related illnesses. So, you know, we don't always, as a food movement, keep our eye on the ball, and the ball really ought to be reducing that gap and addressing poverty, the underlying cause.
Mm-hmm. And do you think the call to raise minimum wage is mm-hmm. addressing that?
I think that's one way to go. I think that's certainly a bandwagon that I think everybody in the food movement should get on. You know, increasing the minimum wage, starting to understand what it means to have a living wage. So minimum wage doesn't necessarily equal a living wage in, you know, some parts of the country. You know, $20, even maybe $25 an hour is more what a living wage looks like. So even bringing the minimum wage up to $15 an hour doesn't necessarily resolve the problem, but it's sure a step in the right direction. I mean, some of the numbers I've seen, you know, suggest that we could actually be saving, as taxpayers, we could be saving money if industry and, you know, all employers were paying at a minimum wage of even $10 an hour. But if they got up to 15, we'd be seeing a reduction in you know, probably in billions and billions of dollars, for instance, in our food stamp budget, the SNAP program, because more and more people would be able to feed themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to keep in mind that, you know, it's not just that, you know, we've shifted the responsibility for feeding people from, you know, the sort of the private sector by dint of wages that allow you to buy healthy, affordable food. But, you know, we've shifted that responsibility to the government and through programs like SNAP.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, some people even say we've shifted some of the responsibility to private corporations who are funding and supporting so many of the food banks and programs like that, and that's part of the problem as to why we're not mobilizing those people who are in need to become activists to fight against the system a bit, because if we encourage that, then the food banks would be kind of going against the corporations that are funding a lot of the food to the food banks.
Yeah, it's so. Kind of a vicious circle. And I give a shout out to my colleague Andy Fisher, who wrote
right, exactly.
Book,
that's what
Big
I was
Hunger.
Thinking of too.
That really he really gets into that discussion about how a lot of our anti-hunger community, is, I guess you could say, is in bed with the with the Walmarts and a lot of the corporations who are producing unhealthy food, distributing unhealthy food, and paying wages that are not, that are below, far below a living wage, not as well as not paying benefits. And of course, this goes back into all the some of the work that the Food Chain Alliance is doing and trying to raise wages for people involved in different aspects of the food industry. But I think in everything, I mean, we can kind of go in sort of item by item through, who is not taking care of whom and who's taking advantage or exploiting whom. But I think that what has to be on the table for every food organization, anybody doing any kind of food work, is this discussion of, inequity in our, not just in our food supply, but inequity in our entire economy. And, the fact that increasing the minimum wage and ultimately reaching a living wage really need to be something that we all own.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of your suggestions in your book to try to help bring all these different food banks and food activists and food organizations together to try to really move forward?
Well, I sort of, in one sense, I could imagine, a very big tent where people who are involved in different aspects of the food movement, and let's be clear about what I'm talking about. I'm, people who are involved in anti-hunger work and food banks, people who are involved in urban agriculture, people promoting and working toward a more sustainable agriculture and food production system, really the whole gamut of what we're talking about, whether it's local food, trying to increase food security, trying to make connections to health in terms of our diet. This is a big, big movement when you look at all the parts. Would it be possible for us to come together around a common agenda? And, that's the question I ask, and then I also present the challenges to that. There's challenges at a local level, and there's challenges at, I think, a national level as well. One area where I think we need to do some more work is communication. We have too often created kind of a them and us separation or divide. We always talk about, what we consider some of the real problems in our food system and tend to kind of disparage people, everyone who's not necessarily producing, organic food and on a small scale. I think we need to sort of like be able to open up a little bit more and put aside some of our biases and see if we can't find some common ground with other groups. So this is, I think this is part of the conversation. It's like the way you communicate and with whom you communicate, rather than living in this echo chamber where you're only talking to a small number of people who agree with you, we have to reach out and begin to talk to people who we might think disagree with us, but in fact probably agree with us more than we think. I think also there's a need that some of our bigger institutions in the food world need to begin to open up and to be a little more flexible. Food banks are certainly one area where there's a need for more flexibility. The anti-hunger world, particularly those who work closely with the SNAP program, need to understand that this can be a good opportunity to promote healthy eating. We haven't really maximized the value of the SNAP program or our food banks in terms of promoting healthy eating. So there has to be a better recognition of that, as well as the fact of what the looking at what the underlying economic issues are with respect to hunger.
Yeah, we have an administration in place right now who, I'm sure you heard, is trying to slash the SNAP program and provide almost like a CSA box, except not with fresh vegetables, but with food, stable foods that are just going to make people sick. I mean, they're just, you know, they
I mean, I completely oppose the administration's proposal. I think that, you know, the SNAP program needs to be funding needs to be increased, not diminished. But at the same time, I think the food movement now finds itself in this bind where, yes, we support the SNAP program, and we also oppose what the administration is proposing with respect to, you know, changes in SNAP. But we've in effect kind of lost an opportunity over the last few years to make some changes in SNAP, you know, such as perhaps eliminating the purchase of sugary soft drinks as one avenue. But not so much taking restrictive approaches as thinking about how can we really maximize the value of, you know, this program that I think it's $50 billion this year, if I'm not mistaken. What could be the value in terms of both local food economies, and what could be the value in terms of encouraging better eating, more incentive-based approaches rather than restrictive or disincentive-based. So, we may lose that opportunity for the next couple of years to have that discussion while we're fighting what amounts to a rear guard action to try to keep SNAP intact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd love to talk more about the incentive idea, because I think there have been many examples where that really has, you know, there's been experiments where that really has shown to be a wonderful way of going, and yet we really don't utilize that very much. But before we do, let's take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, maybe we can explore that a little bit, okay?
Okay.
Everyone listening to us, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Mark Winnie, author of Stand Together or Starve Alone, and you're listening to Bhavani at IE Green. Be right back.
This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and I'm the host of What Women Must Know, every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. As a naturopathic doctor and psychotherapist, I am always seeking the latest solutions to help you rejuvenate and regenerate your body, mind, and spirit. So join me, Dr. Cheryl, and my inspiring guests, authors, health practitioners, and wise elders, to empower yourself by expanding your knowledge about your health and your hormones, and to gain fresh, new perspectives on life. That's What Women Must Know every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Hello, this is Cordelia Gafar. I'm the founder of Workout Around My Day and the Stressless Mom of Six. I have started the new Replenish Me radio show to help moms to have strategies to get through their day and to renew themselves throughout the day with little small self-care tips. And I'll be having interviews with self-love coaches, wellness coaches, just to help you. So join me Thursdays, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and replenish you.
Everybody, it's Beatie Condratos, host of the Ask Beatie Show. Thanks to Audio Now, the Progressive Radio Network now has an app. All you have to do is go to the App Store on your cell phone and search the Progressive Radio Network. You can listen live to PRN shows and also listen to past archive shows. So go to your App Store and download it right now.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm here with my guest, Mark Winnie, author of Stand Together or Starve Alone, Unity and Chaos in the U.S. Food Movement. So, Mark, right before our break, you touched on incentivizing people to eat better, or programs that could encourage better eating and healthy eating and education, basically. Can you talk to us a little bit about some samples of programs that you've seen that seem to work?
Yeah, I'll preface it by saying I think some of the good work that's been done in terms of, let's say, preliminary steps toward better collaboration have been when we bring together at least two or more parts of our food system. So farmers markets, in order to, you know, obviously meet needs of farmers and they meet needs of consumers, but often haven't necessarily met the needs of lower income consumers. They haven't necessarily promoted better food security. And I mean, one way we've been able to resolve that is through a variety of coupon or voucher programs that go by different names. Some of them are federally funded, such as the WIC Farmers Market Nutrition Program. Some of them are privately funded, such as the Double Up Bucks or Double Bucks program, which has added value to SNAP purchases at farmers markets. And, you know, these are, I think, good models for trying to, you know, close some of the gaps that exist in our food system and bringing together different people to work together toward you know, sort of a common agenda and understanding what each other's agenda is. So there's been a lot of private funding for the Double Up Bucks program, which I say goes by different names in different places. Wholesome Wave has been one of the, you know, supporters and funders of that over the years. But there's also a federal version, which is the goes by a funny name. It's called, the acronym is FINNE, but it's the Food Insecurity Nutrition Initiative. I think I have that right. FINNE is the acronym. Mm-hmm. And that provides additional federal funding, I think $20 million a year to help communities provide more incentives to lower income people to shop and buy locally, buy healthy food, and often from locally grown food as well. So, you know, we see this in many, you know, what it's been encouraging. One of the very, I think, strong areas of the food movement have been that, you know, those who are advocates for local food and all of its manifestations have also embraced the idea that everybody, regardless of income, should be able to participate in that food system. You know, we shouldn't keep people out because of income. That doesn't, they shouldn't necessarily be denied the opportunity to buy locally produced food or organic food. And I think that this has been one of the great advances that have been made over the last 10 years. And we see it reflected in some of the policies that have come out of both Washington and other, and also sometimes locally and state levels, that have provided the funding needed to make sure that, you know, we do close that food gap.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So many different questions I have. Let's see. The Double Up Your Food Bucks. I know that that program is mostly in Michigan, isn't it? Is that where
it's called the Fair Food Network, which is based in Michigan, has provided a lot of funding in the Michigan area. But they've also provided some funding around the country, and Wholesome Wave, which I believe is based in Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Mm-hmm. In your book, you talk about a four,
you know, one
food
interesting
point.
You know,
I'm sorry.
Example. It started out, you know, with the idea that we provide incentives to SNAP recipients to buy more food at a farmer's market, but it's also been expanded. There's been an interest in innovation, and one of the innovations has been to provide the same kind of benefits to be people buying fresh produce in regular supermarkets, not necessarily chain supermarkets and not necessarily Whole Foods, but at least independent grocers, so that it can be a year-round supply of produce. So, I mean, we're going to the question of health here. We're going to the question that of obesity and diabetes with their rates that are soaring. How do we encourage people to eat healthier food? One way is to provide those incentives on a year-round basis and make it sometimes a little more accessible than they would be if you were relying on a farmer's market. So there's like, I think that, again, I get excited with all the variations. I went to my own farmer's market in Santa Fe, New Mexico, earlier this summer, and found no less than 5 different incentive programs that had been developed. And this was a market located in the kind of a low to middle income area, and incentives to help people and encourage people to buy local food. Some of them were aimed at children. Some of them were aimed at senior citizens. Others were aimed at people receiving SNAP benefits. But it was kind of exciting. It was kind of exciting to see that innovation. It was kind of, and also to recognize all the different funders of that program. Some of them were private foundations, and others were government.
Mm-hmm. In your book, you talk about the 4 food system points. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. As I mentioned earlier, I think the idea of communication, you know, that what do we, and sometimes we talk more about what we disagree about than what we agree about. And one of the things that I think that we agree about, and this is actually based on some research that's been done by a couple of different groups, is that, as I said earlier, we recognize that lower income people should be able to participate in the sort of the depth and breadth of the food system. They should be able to benefit from locally grown food and from healthy organic food and so forth. They shouldn't be denied that access to those foods because of income. We also, I think, tend to agree that the organic food movement and the sustainable food movement, particularly with respect to growers, is here to stay, even among conventional growers. People who practice conventional agriculture recognize that there is science behind the value of organic food. I think the only question, well, the bigger question that remains is, you know, how is this a practice that I can employ at a local level or in my region because of growing conditions and climate and so forth. So we have some concurrence on that. And then we also know that just the simple idea of local food is now a major economic engine. There was research that was done just a few months ago by the Federal Reserve and the U.S. Department of Agriculture that found that, you know, the local food economy, locally grown food, is adding $6 billion a year of economic value to local economies. And that's just food production. If you start to think about what the local food scene is everywhere now, what do we see? We see, you know, local microbrews. We see coffee shops with, you know, locally roasted coffee. We see, you know, farm-to-table restaurants. We see farmers markets in the town square. It's like undeniable at this point that the local food movement is here to stay, and it's, you know, found, it's gone beyond its beachhead, so to speak, and it's really moved to take over, you know, larger parts of our communities, and that's wonderful. Now, there's a fourth point, and I can't remember what it is.
But I think I've
made the point that we can find a lot of common ground. I want to give you. You mind if I give you one more example?
No, please.
Yeah, this is something that happened to us in Santa Fe, and it was a group of people who were strongly opposed to GMOs, and they went to our city council, and they were proposing a bill that would ban GMOs throughout the city and require any food sold in the city to be labeled as either GMO-free or containing GMOs. Well, unfortunately, these proposals were very impractical and probably illegal, but the folks who were proposing them were well-intentioned. However, they weren't being realistic about whether or not we could actually do something like that in a small city. And instead, what we did is we reframed the argument and said, well, what is going on? What are you really looking for? Well, we're looking for healthy food. We want to make sure that the food we're buying is the best and the healthiest we can. And as a food policy council, and this is what I'm talking about in Santa Fe, and we have a lot of food policy councils around the country, said, well, let's see what we can do to make our own local food system the healthiest one possible. So we engaged our county and our city in such a way that, you know, they are now actively supporting local farms and ranches in Santa Fe County. They have a very vigorous and very robust economic development and planning effort underway to protect and support and enhance agriculture and ranching all throughout our area. Our city has passed new ordinances which make urban farming much easier than it was in the past. We have a food plan that everybody subscribes to in the city that is all about moving in the direction of healthier food. So we sort of took this argument that was a very sort of negative and divisive argument around GMOs and turned it into a win-win-win for everybody by talking about the need for a, you know, a healthy food supply and affordable food supply for everybody. So that's the kind of, when I talk about building collaborations and reframing the arguments and better communication, you know, that's an example of what I mean.
But did that include education about GMOs, or did it not address the GMO issue at all?
It didn't go directly to, you know, there was, didn't go directly to, well, it did go directly to the question of GMOs, because it's talking about, you know, building a, you know, food supply that's not based on GMOs, that, but it's based on local agriculture and so forth. It also does include an emphasis on education, on food education, particularly around cooking and healthy eating and nutrition. We didn't, I don't, as far as I know, we do not have a specific plank, you might say, that, you know, is opposed to GMOs, but, you know, a good education and support of locally produced food and also access for everybody, you know, became the way of looking at this much bigger problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because one of the things that I see is, you know, a lot of greenwashing, you know, where people get on the bandwagon of local and, you know, cashing in on the local food movement, but they are, you know, you go to a farmer's market, and I've seen things at farmer's markets that are, you know, still imported by, you know, from Mexico and Chile, you know, like, you know, produce companies that have a stand at a farmer's market, and it has really not anything to do with local, but they're at the local farmer's market, you know. So I think we also have to have rules at farmer's markets in a sense that the produce is actually grown locally, and, you know, and trying to support local farmers to purchase seeds that are non-GMO, you know, because, you know, you want that. I mean, especially, you know, in my area, you go to certain farmers markets and they might be all organic and non-GMO, and you go to another farmers market, usually in a lower income area, and they're, you can't find an organic farmer at the farmers market.
That's right. Yeah, I'm fully aware of that. I mean, there's been divides just in the farmers market movement itself. In fact, I've seen communities themselves not divide around the fact that you have one farmer's market, which is quite authentic and really is only about local growers, and then another one that is which doesn't pay attention to that issue at all, and it's whoever happens to have produce and who shows up that day. I've seen that they are equally well supported by their respective consumer bases. However, I do think there is that ongoing need for education, that we have to be talking constantly about where this food is coming from and what the value is, you know, not, and the value not just to us as a consumer and not just to our health, but to our communities and to our economies, to create a farmer's market and a local food system, you know, that really does draw on the talents and resources of local agriculture. So I definitely would, you know, definitely support that, but I don't think that we necessarily solve the problem by, you know, continuing to sort of foster conflict and argument over it. And, you know, that we need to work harder at finding common ground.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you'll see that, you know, even when you come here to our local conference, you know, where you're coming for the, as a keynote speaker, you know, we've had issues in just trying to find verbiage that everyone can agree with, because there are some of us on the Food Coalition who really feel like it should be about organic, and others that feel like it's just about local and it's not as important if it's organic. And so there's, you know, and we do constantly work on finding that common ground, because it's challenging.
It is. It is, absolutely. But I'm, you know, and who knows how it can unfold over time. I mean, you know, maybe I've often found that as movements grow, they feel the need to divide, that, you know, certain voices aren't well represented. And they, you know, we've seen this actually in terms of some of the emergence of food justice organizations, that often they haven't felt like their voices are heard within the larger food movement. And they have taken the course of going in a direction that, you know, is more inclusive and accommodating to, you know, the needs of lower income people and people of color. And that's, you know, that haven't necessarily been addressed in the work of other food organizations. And I recognize that as a need that people have. But I think that as divides occur, we also can't just give up. We have to keep reaching out and working very hard. And this is the hardest work there is to find common ground and to collaborate. I won't deny that it's an easy path to go down. You can get bruised and battered pretty easily. But it's definitely ultimately the way that we need to be going, because unless we have that bigger voice and more people at the table, you know, the larger food system is going to overrun us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're right. So where do we go from here? I guess that's the tagline of our conference. Where do we go from here? And that is, you know, the question that I think so many of us, you know, just still have. You know, it's how do we do that? And I really look forward to this upcoming conference. And everybody who is listening, if you are in the New York area, I hope you can join us at the State of Long Island Local Suburban Agricultural Conference at Hofstra on April 19th, where Marky will be our keynote speaker, and we're really looking forward to having you and hosting you. And thank you so much for joining me today. Unfortunately, we're out of time.
Oh, dear. So, really? Thank you.
I know an hour goes fast.
It does. Thanks so much.
It does. You're so welcome, and thank you for joining us. And everyone out there, thank you so much for listening. It's been wonderful having you here, and I'll be with you all again next week. So have a great rest of the week. Enjoy the little bit of snow and the beautiful sunshine, and see you all again next week. Bye for now.